All right. See if my PowerPoint's working this morning. Welcome. We are talking about the Song of Songs. If you're new with us this morning, a couple of things to let you know. One is, if you like the class and would like to know more about what's going on in the class, we do some socials, we do different things. There are communication cards in the back, and you can grab one of those, give me your name and email address, leave it in the bucket, along with the pins, and because you keep stealing my pins, that's where the pins go. Just side note. Leave that in there, and I send out a weekly email just updating you, letting know things that are coming up, and also a link to the video. Now we're trying to video all these classes. So, but just want to welcome you. We are talking through the Song of Songs, which is different. It's been interesting. I hope you're enjoying it. When we think about the Song of Songs, what we've said along the way is that the Song of Songs is not a how-to book. It's not a book that you pick up in the how to make your marriage better section of the bookstore, but the Song of Songs is poetry. And in that, it's an invitation, and it's a celebration of the emotive side of love, of emotion, of passion, of romance, of sex, the passion, the fire of relationships. And I find this really interesting because we often think of God, and I think some of this has to do with, maybe this is more my tradition, this may not be all of yours, but it's easy for me to think of God as almost this impersonal, even though I know he's person, three persons, in fact, and I understand the Trinity and the relationship, but it's easy for me to think of God as sort of this impersonal being who doesn't really care about my emotions. He cares about my mind. And yet God, in his expression of love for us, we find that he is incredibly emotive. And we see this in the life of Christ specifically. And then we read the saints and their responses to God. They're incredibly passionate. Now read David. You know, read Paul. Don't read Paul for the propositions. Listen to how he's speaking. And you find these incredible passion, love, devotion to God. And God's incredible love for us. And so it shouldn't surprise us then that when we think about the most intimate of human relationship, marriage, between a husband and a wife, a man and a woman, that in that God has created us to have this type of emotion, this type of passion. Okay, he does not want us to have passionless marriages. It's not a success for God to say, oh, look, they didn't get divorced for 50 years. Check that box. That's not his goal for your marriage. And so the Song of Songs, what's so unique about it, what is so beautiful about it, is that it invites us to see that side of marriage and to embrace it and to cultivate it and to cherish it. It's not just a how-to book. It's not just how to have better communication or how to deal with kids or your finances. It's actually, in some ways, more important because it's the fire, it's the passion, it's the glue. It's what makes all that 50 years beautiful and worth living. And that's what he wants for your marriage. That's what he wants for my marriage. And so that's why we're talking about this. So what we're going to do, we're going to dive into the next song. And so the way we're dividing this up, I'm not teaching it like a narrative, if you've had it taught before like that. The way I'm teaching it is looking at this as poetry, an anthology of poems that have been put together as songs. And so we're looking at these different songs, and each one of these songs kind of follows a progression of some sort of attraction that leads to some flirting and some other things that are going on, and then ultimately in a physical act. Ultimately, it's all moving through romance and passion towards sexual intimacy. Okay, so here we go, fifth song. And this one should be exciting. All right, Song 5, chapter 5, verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. So this is the woman, okay? This is what she's saying. I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. So the picture is that she's in her bed, and she hears him outside, and he's knocking on the door, and he's like, let me come in, let me come in. Now understand that throughout this one that we're reading, there's a lot of innuendo here. Okay, so this is poetry. Okay, now here's what's happening. She's sleeping, but my heart is awake. And so it's like her heart is listening for him. Her heart listens and is listening for him. And so he's saying, open up to me. Let me come in. I'm knocking at the door. And then I love her response. I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again? Okay. This has never happened in this class ever. But imagine, just be creative. Use your imaginations that one of you, won't say who, is in the mood. And the other one's like, really? I'm kind of tired. It's been a long day. I'm not in the mood. Are you serious? Now? After all? Okay. So I'm sure no one's ever experienced that, but that's the language here. She's saying, really? I'm bathed? I'm all snuggled up in my warm bed. Do I have to get out of bed to let you in again? Because he's outside, remember? Or, depending on how you're reading it, do I have to get bathed again? Because, so understand, she's all tucked in. She's in bed. In Scripture, if you go back into the Old Testament, and remember, this is in the context of the Old Testament. Under the Old Testament law, to have sex would make you ceremonially unclean. Now, understand that does not mean that it's sin. Okay, sexual intercourse is never described as sinful within the context of marriage, never. But the way the Old Testament law works, if you look at it, everyday life activities make you unclean. It's a function of being human and being in the world. It's interacting with the world. You will become unclean. It doesn't mean that it's sinful. There's sort of like different degrees of uncleanness, okay? And so if you were to, as a husband and wife, if you were to be intimate, that didn't mean that you needed to go confess your sin. It wasn't sin. It didn't mean that you needed to make a sacrifice, but it did mean that you needed to take a ritual bath to then be clean again. And so in some sense, it makes sense. Like throughout your day, you'd almost think of it as, well, throughout my day, I'm becoming unclean, and then before I go to bed, I'm going to be clean again. So what she's saying here is, look, if we do what you want to do, what's on your mind, then I've got to get bathed again. Now, this is poetry. And this is romantic poetry. So I don't think that's what she's saying. I don't think she's going, really? You want to do what? Do I really have to put my robe on again? Do I really have to bathe again? Now, what she's teasing him. You see it? Oh, what a trial. What a chore that I will have to do this again, right? She's just teasing him. She's giving him a hard time. She's flirting. Flirting is a good thing, by the way. Okay. All right, let's keep going. All right, actually, hold on. I want to say a couple other things about this before we move on. Actually, I want to say a lot more before we move on. Let me give you a framework for this. When I was growing up, and maybe this was your experience, maybe it wasn't. When I was growing up, the context of my childhood and middle school and high school experience, I grew up in a very traditional home and church and all the rest, and wonderful. I love my church and I love my family. But understand that for me, my experience, the subject of sex was strictly taboo. Okay, we didn't talk about it. And what that communicated to me was a couple of things. And so I went to a private Christian high school as well. And there, again, strictly taboo. You don't talk about it. And it was very clear it was something you should never, ever, ever, ever do. And so what this communicated to me was a couple of things. One, from a Christian perspective, my view of Christianity, okay, from a Christian perspective, as I understood it, sex was something that was not to be spoken of. And as such, it was dirty. It was wrong. It was forbidden. It was almost like this necessary evil that God had invented because he couldn't think of any other way to like propagate the human race. Right? I mean, it was like God in all of his infinite creativity, who could think of nothing else in that moment. He's like, ooh, okay, I guess we'll do this. You know, everything else was good, but this, he was sort of like, I guess we're stuck with this, okay. And the other thing that communicated to me was, one, this was forbidden fruit. And so not from a Christian perspective, from a very much a, like, just high school boy. This was a forbidden fruit. And so what I found was all that my high school and church did to make sure that everyone understood that you should never have sex, that didn't work very well. In fact, I would say that it actually made it worse because it became something that, oh, I shouldn't do this. Well, now I really want to try. Okay. So this was my framework for thinking about sex. And this is maybe some of your backgrounds as well. And I'm going to talk about it towards the end about the importance of how we talk about sex. But what I want to say here is that sex is good. It's hard for some of you, you're like, wait, I know it, but I don't really know it. When God invented sex, like it wasn't something that he was like, ooh, he was like, good. Like he knew what he was doing. I was driving with my two sons, two of my sons. I have three. Two of my sons up to get some baseball equipment at Dick's Sporting Goods. And at the time, it was about a year ago. It was baseball season, so we're headed up there. And Carrie and I kept talking about, okay, at some point we need to start having some of these conversations with them. But we wanted to keep them light. We don't want to like this formal sit down, let me tell you of something that's going to scar you. And so we're driving along and somehow, oh, I know what it was. I couldn't even think of the context. So we needed to get a cup for my son. Okay. and I think his little brother, who's like five at the time, is like, why does he need a cup? Like, what's that about? He's always asking great questions. I said, well, okay. And I start explaining anatomy. Okay. Here's why you have to protect. This is why it hurts. Okay? And we keep talking through it. And the further we go, and they just keep asking questions. I'm like, okay, we may be having this conversation on 75 North, headed up to Dick's Sporting Goods to get a cup. And so, I mean, we are right there, shall we say. So, I mean, we've discussed women's anatomy and men's anatomy and everything, and we just haven't put the two together, okay? And so one of them says, but how does, and I'm like, here we are, okay, and I'm driving. At which point my 8-year-old, wait, I got it from the back seat. This is what I hear. I literally, wait, I got it. Okay. They eat the same foods. Got it. I was like, look, we're here. All right, let's pull in. Let's park. Be done with it. Okay. So God could have done anything, right? He could have done anything. It could have been that two people who are madly in love with each other who have been married could eat the same foods. It could have been that, but that's not what he did. And not only that, but God could have made sex something that's just like, okay. You know, it could have been on par with like eating chocolate or watching a good movie or wearing a really nice sweater in the winter. Right? It could have been something like that. But instead, He creates this this connection that is so incredible, so amazing, so powerful, that it actually is stronger than, in one sense, any other drive, any other appetite that we have. I mean, my appetite for food is very strong, and there's a reason for that. Like, I will die if I don't eat. So it makes sense that it would be really strong. But in one sense, like, our sexual drives are really strong, and no one's life is in danger. Now, you say, yes, but the entirety of the human race is at stake. Okay. Yes, but that's not the whole answer. That's not the whole answer. So look at how God does this. Genesis 2:18, the Lord said, it is not good for the man to be alone. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother to be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And so God, he designs sex to be this expression, the physical expression of a psychological, emotional, mental connection, right? This intimacy that goes beyond any other human relationship that we have. So much so that when you take two people who are committed to one another, who love one another, are devoted to one another, and they come together in the act of marriage, and then literally the act of marriage, it's like it's this glue that connects you to the point that you become almost indistinguishable, essentially inseparable. You are one. Two become a new entity. Okay. And this is the incredible power of what God has done. This is the incredible power of how God has created you and your spouse to come together. That what God puts together in this spiritual act, let no one separate. Now, this is why it's so dangerous as well. And this is why within Christian traditions, especially conservative Christian traditions like the one in which I was raised, there's such a fear of sex because it is so dangerous, because it is so powerful. Okay? So I used the analogy before of like a forest fire. You know, you take something like fire and you put it in the wrong context and it will destroy. But you put it in the right context and it's beautiful. Okay? So we have to understand that sex is dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous. Look at the world around us. It is incredibly dangerous. It destroys lives. It can destroy lives. It can still destroy your life, by the way, if you use it in the wrong context. But within the marriage context, that same power that makes it so dangerous now becomes a power to connect, to protect your marriage. So when I'm talking to my kids, all right, my conversation with them is going to be different than the conversation I want to have with you. Because theoretically, you're in here, you're married, we're going to talk about sex purely in the positive. Okay, I'm going to assume you're married and you are committed. Yes, good. Now we get to talk about the great side of sex. But to my kids, what I want to explain to them is this is what it will be, okay, for you. But along the way, understand there's a few realities. One is that sex, because it is so powerful, it is also valuable. That you are valuable, and if you give that away outside of the context of marriage, then you are giving something that is of infinite value away for free. And that's actually not the way that God has designed it, okay? But secondly, it's dangerous because it is something designed to attach you to another person. And when it's not used that way for a lifetime, there's a tearing that happens. And if you've ever been torn physically, you understand that it does irreparable damage. There will be scars that are left over. You know, I think of it as like, imagine that you got the name of every single person that you ever dated tattooed on your arm. And between each one, you had it removed. And then you got a new one, and you got it removed, and you had a new one. You would be left with scar tissue there. And so it's the same idea, only worse, that when two people are torn apart, there is a tearing that's involved. Now, the other thing I say is this, and some of you need to hear this, and this is the most important, that God's grace is sufficient for all of it. God's grace covers all of it. And that even if you entered your marriage and you go, okay, I felt some of those scars. By the way, pretty much everybody has those scars in one way or another when you enter your marriage. And yet, God in His grace, even your scars fit together. Okay, so that's what I want to tell my kids. We're having fun. All right, so we get to say, hey, that part that's so dangerous is essential for your marriage. Okay, so the fire that's raging, that's burning somebody's house down, that's horrible, in my fireplace, when it's cold on a winter's night, oh man, that's beautiful. It's warm. It's essential. If I don't have it, well, I have gas heat. So that's regards. But within your marriage, if you don't have it, then you are in danger. And this is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. Now, for the matters you wrote about. So the Corinthian church there is writing a letter to Paul, and he's quoting back. He's answering them. Give you the context. Now, for the matters you wrote about, and you can almost put this in quotations, it is good for a man not to marry. In fact, more literally, a translation is like, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Okay. And so he's reading that back to them. He's quoting it back. He says, okay, this is what you're saying. And now he's gonna say, not quite. And here's what we think was going on in Corinth. We think that the believers there, they had this hyper-spiritualized view of Christianity in the sense of like, well, everything that is physical and of bodies, that is low. And there's only spirit that is high. And so even believers were saying, well, we're not going to have sex. Married couples were saying, well, we're not going to have sex because that's base. That is low. We don't do that. We're hyper-spiritual, super spiritual, because we don't even have to have sex with our husbands and wives. He says, but since there is so much immorality, each man, by the way, notice it didn't work. Yeah. backfire. All right. There's so much immorality. Each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. And in the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time. In other words, if you do it, you better put an end date on it so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. So, okay, you want to take a break? Here's a good reason to take a break, but you better have an end date. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So notice what Paul's saying here. If you in your marriage, if you and your spouse, for whatever reason, you are not having sexual intimacy, you are setting yourselves up for disaster. That same power that is so devastating outside of marriage is necessary within your marriage to protect your marriage, to hold you together. It's essential. And if you lose that, you are creating an avenue for Satan to destroy your marriage. And understand, Satan wants to destroy your marriage. He hates all that is beautiful and good. And so he looks at your marriage and he has a sight set on it. There's a giant bullseye on your marriage, I promise you. And the better it is, the bigger the bullseye it gets. And so he's looking for ways to tear you apart and to split you up and to turn you on one another. And this is one of the most tangible ways that he does that. So think about this for a second. Okay. Let me say a couple of things about this passage, and then I'm going to explain how this can be dangerous. One, this is really important. You may not use this passage to bully your spouse. Okay, so nobody's right scribbling this down like using this later. No. Go just a few chapters over, chapter 13, and what does Paul say about love? Love does not seek its own. It doesn't force its own demands upon another person. Okay, so understand, you don't get to abuse this. You don't get to bully your spouse with this. Okay, love doesn't demand its own, and so you don't get to say, "Well, see, Paul said you have to have sex with me." That's a terrible. Do you really want your spouse to sleep with you because you did that? Is that really what you're going for? That's a bad idea. Okay, so notice the mutual goal here is mutual satisfaction. It's that the two of you come together. But, as we said before, let's imagine a scenario. Just use your imaginations. Where one of you is not in the mood, and one of you is in the mood. Okay, you don't get to use this passage. You don't get to say, "Oh yeah, but 1 Corinthians 7, would you like to read the Bible together tonight, honey? I know just the passage." You don't get to do that. Right. But what Paul's saying here is there are those times when one of you is in the mood, one of you is not. And so in those moments, there's a couple of ways that we need to think about this. Out of love for one another, there are times where let's just use husbands and wives, and by the way, this can go either way, all right? So don't hear me saying this is how it always is. But we're going to use husbands and wives, that the husband says, "Honey, guess what?" And she's going, "Really? You want me to bathe again? You want me to put on my robe again?" She's giving this whole thing. There are times when the husband, out of love for his wife, he needs to think, okay, what does she need? Let's think about her day. She's been at work all day. Something went bad with her boss. She's been home with the kids all day. She's had to deal with all this. What does she need? Maybe she needs a back rub, not sex. And so that's where he puts her interests ahead of his own. And then vice versa, there are times when the wife in that same situation, you need to think, okay, my husband needs me. My husband wants me. That's a good thing. And so maybe this is one of those times where I may not be in the mood, but I'm going to get in the mood. And so that's where the two of you together, out of love for one another, you put each other's needs ahead of its own. And one night it may go one way, another night it may go a different way. That's okay. But what's important is that the goal here, again, is mutual satisfaction. What's going to be good for both of you? And that's what Paul wants. Now, but here's the warning. And this is where Satan creeps in. If you deny your spouse too often, if you are never in the mood, if you always reject him or always reject her, bitterness will set in. Because your husband will feel like he's not wanted. Your wife will feel like she's not desirable. And bitterness will set in, and eventually your relationship will sour. And that's what this is the danger. This is why Satan is like, yes, you should pray and never have sex. Think about that. He's like, hey, that'd be great if you fasted from sex and prayed all the time. Satan would be on board with that because he knows bitterness sets in. It's how we're wired. And then your relationship will sour. All right. One more thing. So this is a shocker. I know. But this is important for understanding why it's so important for both of you in a different way to come together in sexual intimacy. And let me say, I'm going to tread very lightly here because a couple of reasons. One is this. When I'm speaking to 1,000 people, I can speak in generalities and everybody goes, of course, that's what you have to do. And if I'm sitting down, I'm speaking with just like one couple or one person, we can get very specific to how you're wired. This is like the worst case scenario because it's just, you know, intimate enough that you're like, but that's not exactly me. That's not my situation, but I kind of still have to talk in generalities. Okay. So if you'll be gracious with me, I'm going to speak in some generalities. It may not be you exactly. I almost guarantee that it's not because we're really complex people. Everybody's relationship is different. The other side of this is I'm going to say something about women's sexual needs, and I am not a woman. And by the way, I started to say at one point, I told Carrie this, I said, well, I'll give a disclaimer that I've read a bunch of other books that talk about the women's sexual needs and how she views that. And then I realized they're all written by men. So if you have some better ones written by women, send me a link or something. That would be helpful. So what I have done is I have consulted my beautiful and very feminine wife, Carrie, and she's given me like a partial thumbs up, like kind of, you know, because again, it's general, so it's not exactly her. So any mistakes are mine, not hers. Okay, if you're like that's nonsense, it's me. Okay, so here's the two sides of this. For guys, again, generally speaking, sexual fulfillment, okay, to be sexually satisfied, leads to satisfaction with life. So you show me a guy who has a great sex life at home, then I will show you a guy who is a better husband, who is a more engaged father, who doesn't think his boss is that bad, and his job really doesn't suck that much, and the sky is bluer, and the grass is greener, and life is just a little bit better. There's this satisfaction with all of life. It is so strong in how guys are wired that it actually changes the way that we see the rest of the world. Okay. And so in a very real sense, generally speaking, men who are sexually fulfilled in their marriages, that leads to a satisfaction with life. Okay. On the flip side, you could almost reverse this for women. That for women, and not even so much satisfaction with life, but satisfaction with marriage is actually what leads to sexual satisfaction. Do you see how it goes in opposite directions? Okay. And so for ladies, put it this way, if you want your husbands to be better husbands and better fathers and to be more engaged at home and in life and to not hate their job so much and to like their life and to be satisfied in your marriage, in many ways it starts in the bedroom. I know that's a crazy idea. You're like, what is wrong with him? I get it. I don't understand it either. Okay. But on the flip side, guys, if you want your wife to be satisfied sexually, it actually starts everywhere else. It doesn't start in the bedroom. It starts, as we've said, in the kitchen. It starts everywhere else in your life. How are you treating her? I thought of this analogy. I don't know if this makes any sense, but so for guys, if you imagine life is like a meal. See, for guys, in a sense, sex is the entire meal. it's the appetizer and it's the salad and it's the main course and it's the dessert and it's the aperitif and it's the nightcap. It's the whole thing. It's the whole thing. Just that one, we can go through our entire day and then have one meal that night and we're satisfied. For women, at best, sex is like dessert, right? And the meal, guess when it started? That morning, when you woke up. At best, I could probably make a case that the meal is ongoing. It's like a progressive dinner. And by the way, each course that you have colors the quality of the next one that they're going to have. Okay, so they're all connected. It's all interlinked. See, we compartmentalize. See, guys are very simple in the sense of my entire day, and then compartmentally, it's like, you know, go through your entire day, and it can suck. It can be terrible. And then that night, Carrie goes, I have an idea. Best day ever. Right? Luckiest man alive. Greatest marriage. Okay. And for women, it is not that way. It is so, women are so much more complex with how all of this interlinks. And so, again, as crazy as it sounds, ladies, if you want your husbands to find your marriage satisfying, their marriage with you satisfying, it starts in the bedroom. I know it's crazy, but guys, if you want your wives to be satisfied sexually, it starts everywhere else. Don't forget that. Okay. I'm sure there's a lot more that we could say here. But in the interest of time, we got to keep going. Okay. So again, I'm not gonna parse this out for you. Just understand this is poetry. My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I rose to open for my lover. My hands dripped with myrrh. My fingers were with flowing myrrh on the handles of the lock. Yep. So it's poetic. It's not pornographic. He does that. He's writing this way intentionally. But can you believe that God, through the Holy Spirit, wrote this? This is what he thinks sex is pretty beautiful. Okay. I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. So she goes out looking. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. The picture he's painting here is this. Don't get too literal. Again, it's poetry. She's saying, look, when you're not there, I'm defenseless. Life is terrible. Life is a disaster. I mean, it can't get any worse. When she wakes up and he's not there, catastrophe. Okay? It's awful. Where are you? She is desperate to find him. So she turns to her friends. Oh, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love. And she's like, somebody find him for me. There's this desperation. But this is great. I love this. So they ask her. She says, you got to find him for me. And they go, why? How is your beloved better than others, most beautiful of women? How is your beloved better than others that you charge us so? In other words, they're like, well, what's so great about this guy? And again, it's poetry. So now she gets the opportunity. Remember how in the previous, there were moments where the husband would praise his wife. You're all how beautiful she is. Well, here the tables are turned. By the way, ladies, how do you talk about your husband when your friends ask what's so great about him? Just hold on to that. So here she's describing him. My lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. I prefer one in a million, but evidently one in 10,000 is pretty good. His head is pure as gold. His hair is wavy and black as a raven. That's very overrated on a side note. Okay. His eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in milk, mounted like jewels. His cheeks are like beds of spice, yielding perfume. His lips are like lilies, dripping with myrrh. His arms are rods of gold, set with chrysolite. His body is like polished ivory, decorated with sapphires. What she's basically saying here is he is godlike. In other words, looks something like this. Yeah. By the way, look, this is, just to be fair, this is a movie, okay? I mean, in real life, like, he can't possibly, oh my goodness, he is. me? Now here's, okay, let me tell you something. This is tell you a big difference between men and women, okay? Every guy, just a little bit, they were like, eh, I'm as good looking as that guy. You know, there's a little bit, like guys just have this ego. Okay, so here, let me spell it out like this. Listen, it's like this. When a guy looks in the mirror, you know what he says? Not bad. Not bad. You know, I mean, I'm not Thor, but not bad. Ladies, when you look in the mirror, you know what you tend to think? Not good. Guys, this was pointed out to me actually by multiple people last week when we talked about the beauty of our wives and expressing that to them, that they don't believe us. In fact, a couple of people mentioned it to me, and then most recently it was that sage of our days, of our day, Bruno Mars, who said, you know, I tell her how beautiful she is and she doesn't believe me. And so when she asks how I look, I say, you look amazing. I don't remember the exact words, but anyway, so he's saying the same thing. So guys, your wives don't believe you. You have to try harder. And ladies, believe your husbands, because they really do think that you are beautiful. And they think that you are sexy. They think you're attractive. They love you. But you got to believe them. You got to believe them. Don't let all those lies sneak in. You got to believe them. The beauty of being a guy is, if Carrie tells me I look like this, it doesn't matter even if I look like this. It's like, not bad. Kind of do, right? The reality, look, I'll be honest. I know that I don't look like Chris Hemsworth. I'm more of a bald Tom Cruise. Why are you laughing? You're hurting my feelings right now. You're hurting my feelings. All right. His legs are pillars of marble set on bases of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice is its cedar. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. This is my lover. This is my friend. I wish we had time to camp here for a second, but this is my lover. This is my friend. Oh, daughters of Jerusalem, there's a beauty to this relationship that goes far beyond friendship, but is not less than. And so now we're back to our gardening scenes. Where has your lover gone, most beautiful of women? Which way did your lover turn that we may look for him with you? My lover has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to browse in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my lover's and my lover is mine. He browses among the lilies. And then the door closes. This is the end of the song. And so again, the picture is innuendo, right? This is the two of them coming together and there is gardening going on, as I said before. So let me hit this really quick. One of the keys, I do not have much time, so I'm going to try to get through this. If you got to go, I understand. One of the keys to better gardening is communication. And here's the reality that I find as I talk to couples, as I work with couples. The only thing that makes you feel more vulnerable, that can be scarier than actually coming together in sexual intimacy, because think about how vulnerable that act is to talk about it. And oftentimes couples struggle because they have difficulty talking about their sex life with one another. Because it is an incredibly vulnerable place to be. To say, to want to have this conversation of, this isn't working for me, or I would like this, or I don't like this, or this makes me uncomfortable, or whatever that frustration or dissatisfaction that everyone feels at times in their marriage. And yet it can be incredibly frightening to, not literally, but disrobe, right? In that moment, it's actually more terrifying and more vulnerable than sex itself. So, but here's the deal though. You have to. Like it really is important that you have these conversations. But let me give you a couple of very quick do's and don'ts for how to have this conversation that maybe you'll find helpful. Okay. The first is this: do talk with your talk about sex with your spouse, but don't ambush them. So this may sound counterintuitive, but when you are actually lying in bed together is not the time to start complaining about something or airing your frustrations. I suggest finding a neutral time and place and even giving them advance warning. But look, don't say, "I'm really unhappy with all of this. I want to talk about it." Nobody wants to show up to that appointment. You know what the appointment they want to show up with is? "I love you so much. I love having sex with you. I want to talk about how to make it better." Now that I show up for. Okay. So how you frame it matters. Okay. But don't ambush your spouse. They're blindsided by what's coming. It can be incredibly hurtful. And that's why this is so, remember, this is so vulnerable. You can do very serious damage to your spouse if you don't handle this well. Okay. Next, do share your desires with your spouse, but don't try to cover everything in one conversation. So what happens is a guy will be like, "I wish that she'd be more adventurous. I wish she'd initiate more. I wish we'd try new things. I wish that she would," and like has this whole litany of things. Stop. Or she has this whole list of things. "I wish he wouldn't do this. I wish he would try this. I wish he, you know, I don't want to have sex as often as he does." And she's got a whole litany of things. If you go to your spouse and you list off 5 or 6 things, what have you just communicated to them? You are doing a terrible job. You are terrible to have sex with. I've just given you a whole list of all the ways you are doing this badly. Okay. So again, we have to think about how do we put this in, how are we tactful with this conversation? And so realizing that this is such a vulnerable conversation and that sex itself is a complex reality of emotion and psychology and your relationship and all of it put together, if you will cover one thing at a time, as specifically, as concretely as possible, then you will not confuse the issue. Because what you do not want to communicate is all this unspoken stuff. And that's what he will hear, that's what she will hear. So keep it simple. "I love having sex with you. I want it to be better. This is one thing that I've been thinking about." Okay? All right. Got to keep going. Do make positive suggestions. Don't complain. Don't belittle or pressure. So this, very simple. Whenever you are trying to express how you feel about whatever that is within this context, if you will couch it in positive terms instead of saying, "I hate it when you do this," instead of saying, "I love it when you do this," or "I would love it if you would do this." See, that's encouraging. And you haven't just told them you're doing a terrible job. Because again, super vulnerable. You can do a lot of damage. So be careful. Their heart is in your hands when you're having this conversation. There are a few areas in your life where your spouse feels more vulnerable than in that conversation. So do it well. Okay. I wrote in my notes, "I prefer it when you do," don't say it, "I hate it when you do that." "I prefer it when you do this," or "I would love it if you would do this." "I'd love it if you'd try this," not, "Why don't you ever do this?" Okay? And don't ever say, "I bet so-and-so's spouse would do this." Because you'll be on the couch for a long time. All right, do ask questions about your spouse's desires. Be a student of your spouse's sexual needs. And here's what I mean by that. You have an incredible privilege of getting to know them like nobody else does. So be a PhD level student, okay? And when you ask questions, you are then giving them an opportunity to express what they may feel too scared to say. Okay? So you're opening that up. But whatever they say, you don't get to go, "What? No." Or, "Really?" Or, like, no. You're listening, okay? So don't judge. Okay. If you want to, if you want them to open up to you, don't judge, because otherwise they will close themselves off to you. Okay. And you're going to have to work to earn back that trust. So don't judge. Do have a sense of humor. Don't make this a life and death thing. sex is super important. It's really important to your marriage. But if you go into the conversation as though your marriage hangs in the balance over this, no, it doesn't. Okay. Sex is awkward to talk about. I should know. I'm up here. It's silly. It's weird. So laugh about it. Have fun with it. Communicate to your spouse that this is a team effort. We are figuring out how to make it even better. And like I said, you know, just don't take it too seriously. If you come to your spouse and it's like, this is going to make or break us, then it'll break you. Okay? It's a process. You don't solve it. It's a journey together. All right. I got to wrap up. I'm over time, but let me pray for us. We got two more weeks in the songs and then we're going to move on to something as yet to be determined. But let me pray for us. Lord, we love you. And thank you that sex was your idea. Thank you that it is beautiful. And you didn't look at it and shudder. It wasn't a last resort. It wasn't because you had nothing else you could do, but you created it to be this incredibly strong connection between husbands and wives. And so, Lord, I pray that you'd bless each couple here. I pray that you would bless their marriages. I pray that they would, Lord, glorify you in all things, including our sex lives. Lord, we love you. In Jesus' name, amen.